It's showtime, folks!
This is Sully on Sports, the show dedicated to everything sports.
Hey, how you doing? Come on in and stay a while. You're listening to Sully on Sports, the show dedicated to everything sports. Matt Solomon coming to you, as always, from the Gordon Bombay Studios.
Now go to that voodoo that you do.
This being the episode for July 8th, 2022, we've got plenty, and I mean plenty, to dive into on the show today. I know it's been a while since we joined you last, but we're going to get into stuff happening around the world of Major League Baseball. We got the All-Star Game coming up in about a little over a week from now, as we've already hit the halfway point of the Major League Baseball season. We get into all the happenings coming on from around there. We got a big trade in the NFL that we feel like we got to talk about. We got a lot going on with the first round of the draft. The major trades happening. The Hockey Hall of Fame inductions. We got plenty to talk about there with the happenings in the NHL. But I just figured I would rip the Band-Aid off and get this out of the way now, as we've got plenty to talk about in the NBA as well. Especially a lot of drama, surprise, surprise, surrounding the Brooklyn Nets. Let's get into that right now, as it's time for us to
rock the rim.
So there's been a lot, and I mean a lot, of stuff to try to digest from what's been happening with the NBA as of late. We've had stars signing supermax contracts like crazy to be able to want to stay put in certain cities. We've had Devin Booker sign a four-year extension with Phoenix for over $220 million. Ja Morant, and rightfully so, signed a four-year design rookie extension, likely worth $226 million to stay in Memphis, which is a great deal for the Grizzlies because, let's face facts, Ja Morant's the biggest star on that team. Denver signed Nikola Jokic. Let me try that sentence again. Denver re-signed Nikola Jokic to the richest contract in NBA history, a five-year deal worth $264 million. And reading that number was so eye-popping, I ended up stumbling over my own words trying to be able to comprehend how much Jokic was signed for in Denver. And you know what? Good for Jokic getting that much money, because let's face facts, Nikola Jokic is the face of the franchise for the Denver Nuggets. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. This guy is worth every penny and then some. Now, if the Nuggets can only be able to properly build a little bit better around Nikola Jokic, then Denver would be in great shape to be able to possibly try to get past the hump, if you will, as becoming one of the big premier threat teams in the Western Conference, and finally get over that hump as being able to be one of, if not the team, to be able to knock off like Golden State as the top dog in the Western Conference. I mean, you've got talent there with Jokic. You've got Porter. You've got Caldwell Pope. You got Jamal Murray. You got Jeff Green coming off the bench. But I think there's still something missing from Denver to be able to really, truly help Nikola Jokic out. So you've got all these guys signing supermax contracts. You got Karl Anthony Towns signing a four-year deal in Minnesota worth $224 million on a supermax extension. But the big thing that everybody's been talking about has been coming out of Brooklyn. And it's Kyrie Irving opting in for next year for $36.5 million to stay in Brooklyn. And now Kevin Durant wants out. He's asked Brooklyn owner Joe Tsai for a trade on Thursday, listing his two preferred destinations as either Miami or Phoenix.
What the hell?
You gotta be paping me!
And that's not reactions to where so much Durant wants to end up as the fact that he wants off the Nets in the first place. Wasn't this guy signed to a major contract to try to be able to prove to people and give a shot at running his own team and having everything kind of be his own way? I mean, I'm seriously wondering
what the hell
is running through the mind of Kevin Durant. I realize, and this is going to prove, that if anybody who's followed the NBA, and I've talked about this on this show in the past, and anybody who's followed the NBA, I know we're based out of Tampa now, but if anybody who's followed the NBA in the New York market will tell you, or anybody who's followed the NBA period, knows that it's a three-ring circus coming out of New York as far as basketball is concerned. And usually, when you mention three-ring circuses and New York basketball, 99% of the time, you're generally talking about the New York Knicks for either bad play on the court or horrible management by either the GM or the owner. Rarely are you hearing about mismanagement by the Nets, except for as of late. The Nets have kind of turned it around as to being the three-ring circus as far as New York basketball is concerned. Because this was the team that was supposed to finally take the spotlight away from the Knicks and get it shown directly on them and have them being a good team. Because this was, on paper, supposed to be a very, very good Nets team. They had their own version of a big three with James Harden, Kevin Durant, and Kyrie Irving. Right? It was supposed to be a big deal. But Durant couldn't stay healthy after signing the Supermax contract. Kyrie was dealing with whatever he was dealing with getting the vaccine and being able to play home games in New York and whatnot, which, by the way, was a circus in and of itself, which we've talked about at length here on the show. And eventually, James Harden grew tired of dealing with said three-ring circus between Kyrie and KD, and what was going on with them, and being the only star on the court, that Harden eventually expressed displeasure with the team, wanted out, got traded to Philadelphia, Ben Simmons comes in, and that's been its own three-ring circus on its own, with all the stuff going on with Ben Simmons, with him being able to figure out, you know, is he going to play, what's going to happen with Ben Simmons, you know, what was his deal in Philadelphia? Were we ever going to see him on the court again? Blah, 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 blah. Ben Simmons hasn't played a minute for the Nets since they got him in the Harden trade. Kyrie wants to come back, and Kyrie's opted in for one more year, but now KD wants out. And no real explanation from what I've been looking up and I've been trying to read is that there's no real explanation as to why KD wants out. And it's been an entire debacle. I mean, everybody seems like, wow, this has escalated quickly. No, it hasn't. The writing has been on the wall for a while now, I think, with this being the ultimate three-ring circus that it is, with showing, you know, that Kyrie had his own problems, Durant couldn't stay healthy, Harden wanted out, and KD, I think, was tired of being... It was supposed to be the KD-Kyrie show in Brooklyn, and they were supposed to be the two guys that were going to bring Brooklyn back to prominence, and they were going to have the team built around them. And my immediate reaction to KD wanting out was, I'm not really surprised. I think KD realized he had a good thing going with Steph and Klay out in Golden State, and he'd won titles there, he had a good thing going there, and I think he realized after a couple of years, okay, first year wasn't going to happen anyway because he was coming off the injury. And then the last couple of years, it's been, all right, this is not working out with me and Kyrie. Kyrie's going to stay here. I think Durant's looking at this like, all right, there's only enough room for one big ego player on this team, and it's going to be Kyrie. If Kyrie's staying, I'm gone. That's, I think, where this is my reaction to it, at least, is like, all right, you know, Kyrie's the big guy here. Kyrie's going to be the star here. I want out. It's like, this is not going to work. That's how I'm reading this. I could be reading it completely, totally, and utterly wrong. And some people are asking, where did it go wrong in Brooklyn? It's been going wrong for the last couple of years with horrible mismanagement. Normally, this is a Knicks ploy. Not something the Nets would do. But this is totally a Knicks ploy. And it's, everybody was so focused on, how do I put this? Everybody was so focused on what Kyrie and KD wanted to do in Brooklyn that the Nets kind of got away from being the Nets, if you will. They got away from what they wanted to do to be able to build a successful franchise because they were so focused on trying to make those two guys happy and pampering their asses that they forgot who they were. This whole situation has been really screwed up from the start with Kyrie and KD trying to play together, which some people figured it would be with the two massive egos that those two guys have. They figured it was going to end up biting them in the rear end, and so far, ta-da! It looks like it has, because this experiment has completely flopped. Kyrie couldn't stay on the court because he was dealing with the vaccine mandates in New York City and didn't want to get vaccinated for... And he's losing out on all this money and the ability to play and whatever, which caused headache enough for the Nets. Now that Kyrie's back in for one more year, KD wants out. I'm like, just shut up and play basketball. That's the way I look at it. Just shut up and play frickin' basketball. This shouldn't be that hard of a concept, but apparently for KD and Kyrie, it is. So, that's the big story and that's the big headache with everything going on in the NBA. I'm not going to waste too much more time on this. Because I feel that wasting more time on Kyrie and KD is going to keep feeding their egos even more. So I'm cutting it off right there. But that's what's been going on with the Nets, who have apparently turned into more of a three-ring circus than the New York Knicks, which is saying a lot. So we got that going on. We've had a big trade. And well, speaking of big trades, KD wants out of Brooklyn. Well, we got another guy who's finally gotten the trade he's been looking for. This taking place in Cleveland. Let's get into that right now, really quickly, as it's time for us to talk a little football.
Pat, I think it's safe to say that all these fans came out here to watch a game of football.
John, we're in commercial.
Yeah, I know. I'm just making conversation. Come on. Football!
So with us being just around the corner from the start of training camp in the NFL, as the regular season gets geared up to kick off in September, we've got plenty to talk about from the NFL. Well, actually, we haven't had plenty to talk about, except for the big trade that the Cleveland Browns finally pulled the trigger on. There had been rumors floating around with this for a while as to whether or not Cleveland was actually going to be able to pull off making this deal or not, but the Cleveland Browns have finally gone ahead and decided to make the trade that everybody knew was coming. The Browns have finally traded Baker Mayfield, which was a given for a while now. They've traded him to the Carolina Panthers for a 2024 conditional draft pick.
Holy shnikes.
I gotta be honest with you, I'm surprised it took this long for Cleveland to finally pull the trigger on it and getting Baker traded in the first place. The writing's been on the wall since the Browns were dumb enough to trade for Deshaun Watson with all the crap that he's been going through. I'm surprised it took the Browns that long to be able to make that trade. I'm surprised the Browns were dumb enough to make that trade. But the Browns made the trade to get Deshaun Watson out of Houston, and it was only a matter of time. You knew it was coming. You absolutely knew it was coming, and it was only a matter of time before Baker was going to get moved. You knew it. It had to happen that Baker was going to get traded. Absolutely had to happen that it was going to get traded, that Baker was going to go bye-bye. Because the Browns only had room on the quarterback depth chart for one, and what they figured with all the money and stuff they invested in Deshaun Watson, they figured, all right, fine, you know, trade him, just get rid of him, blah, blah, blah. You know, do whatever with him. So they finally got rid of Baker, sent him to Carolina, and looking at the four quarterbacks in that division, looking at the quarterbacks in that NFC North, in the NFC South, rather, think about the quarterbacks that are in that are starting right there. You have a former number one overall pick in Carolina in Baker Mayfield, right? You got him slinging the ball there. Baker went number one. Looking at the depth chart in Atlanta, you still have Marcus Mariota as the starting quarterback there. Mariota was also a top three draft pick. Then you look at New Orleans and who they have on the depth chart right now as the starting quarterback, that being Jameis Winston. And you have Andy Dalton as his backup. But the three quarterbacks right there all went in the top three. Winston, Mariota, and now Baker Mayfield. And you also have Sam Darnold as his backup. The other quarterback in that division went 199th overall and is a 7-time Super Bowl winner in Tom Brady. So that's going to be an interesting division for quarterback play this year, with Mariota, Winston, and now Mayfield thrown in with Brady in the NFC South. That's going to be a tough division to play against this year. And with Baker, he's got to be relieved as all hell to be out of that sideshow circus in Cleveland. He has to be. I mean, he had a good year a couple of years ago which the Browns went to the playoffs. They went 11-5. Baker threw for over 3,500 yards, 26 touchdowns, excuse me, to just 8 interceptions. Last year, came back down to earth, went 6-8, threw for a shade over 3,000 yards, had 17 touchdowns and 13 picks, seemed to come back down to reality a little bit. But I like what Baker now has to work with, because this is a chance for Baker Mayfield to kind of, in a way, resurrect his career almost. Because look at what happened in Cleveland. Look at what he's now got to deal with in, as far as weapons are concerned, in Carolina. All right, look what he's leaving first in Cleveland. All right, Cleveland's messed up anyway. They got Deshaun Watson at quarterback, and they have Jacoby Brissett as a backup. Okay, you knew going in that Deshaun Watson was going to be the guy, but they've got Amari Cooper left at receiver as being the guy. Because they got rid of Odell. They got rid of Landry. They had weapons for whoever the hell was a quarterback to work with. And now the only major threat left is Amari Cooper. No disrespect to Donovan Peoples-Jones and David Bell and David Njoku at tight end and Nick Chubb at running back. But let's face facts. The biggest weapon is Amari Cooper. When you had Cooper, Odell, and you had Jarvis Landry, you had a lot of weapons for Baker to work with. Now, he's led over to Carolina. He's got DJ Moore and Robbie Anderson to throw to, which isn't so bad. And depending on how healthy and how productive he can be, you still have one of the premier running backs in football available to you to be able to hand the ball off to in Christian McCaffrey. So if you're Baker, this is a good way to sort of resurrect your career, right? This is a good chance for Baker Mayfield to be able to really find his game again and go back to the Baker Mayfield we saw in 2019 that led the Browns to the playoffs and led the Browns to an 11-5 record. This is the chance for Baker to remind the football world of why he was taken number one overall when the Browns took him. So I'm really intrigued to see what he's going to be able to do now with a fresh start in Carolina. And one guy I kind of almost feel bad for out of all of this is Sam Darnold now. Because Sam was put in the same situation in that he was looking for more stability. He was in a horrible situation with the Jets. And I'll be the first one to admit that coming from a Jet fan. But Sam Darnold was in a horrible situation with the Jets, and where he had a head coach and an offensive coordinator carousel floating all around him. It's like he didn't know which end was up, and he didn't have a set system to work with while he was still in New York. So I really felt bad for Sam Darnold playing here because he had no weapons and he had no set and solid coaching staff. They traded away his best weapon and one of his best friends in Robbie Anderson to Carolina in the first place. Now he gets back with Robbie Anderson, and it seems like Sam Darnold can't get his feet on the ground in Carolina either, because once he got to Carolina, he went 4-7, threw for, yes, more yards than he threw for his last year with the Jets, but again had the same touchdown to interception problem. 9 touchdowns compared to 13 interceptions last year in Carolina. So Sam couldn't really get his feet under him with the Panthers. And now he's got, he's being relegated to a backup role with Baker Mayfield coming into the mix. Sam Darnold can't catch a break. The guy's never been able to stay healthy since the Jets took him. He's never played a full 16 games. His best year was in 2019 when he actually had a winning record going 7-6, but a lot of that wasn't until he was able to turn it on in the second half of the season, by which point the Jets were already well out of contention in 2019. So, part of me really feels bad for Sam Darnold having to put up with some of the crap that he's had to put up with, and now he's being relegated to a backup role with Baker Mayfield coming into the mix. And like I said, for as bad as I feel for Sam, I'm happy for Baker for being able to kind of finally get the playing time and being able to get a shot to resurrect his career. And while all this was going on with the Browns trying to figure out what to do with Baker Mayfield, they finally announced the list of people eligible for the Pro Football Hall of Fame for 2023. It's headlined, at least nothing's been officially announced yet. We don't have Hall of Fame finalist or Hall of Fame class for the NFL or for the Pro Football Hall of Fame, officially announced. But the 54 semifinalists have come out, and it's being led by Mike Shanahan and Mike Holmgren amongst the coaches that are on the list for being eligible for election into the Hall of Fame. The players, some of the big names that still pop out as being semifinalists, include Ken Anderson, the quarterback, Roger Craig, the running back, Billy White Shoes Johnson, Clay Matthews, who else is Sterling Sharp, Joe Klecko, Jim Marshall. So we got a few big names that are up for eligibility for the Hall of Fame this year. Shanahan and Holmgren should be able to both get in. For what both guys did for their coaching careers, they should be a lock, it seems, for getting into the Hall of Fame. Out of the players that are listed for eligible, and the results are going to be announced at the end of July, who's getting into the Hall of Fame. But I could see Craig Anderson making it in. I could see Clay Matthews getting in for his ability as a linebacker. I could see Joe Klecko and Jim Marshall possibly getting in. Klecko deserves to be in my mind. Klecko was one of the better defensive ends in his time. But Klecko deserves to be able to get in. We'll find out more when the Hall of Fame class officially gets announced at the end of July. But that is what we're looking like for eligibility for the Football Hall of Fame in 2023. And speaking of Hall of Fame eligibility, the Hockey Hall of Fame has announced their eligibility class, has announced their Hall of Fame class for 2022. Let's get into that right now, as it's time for us to go.
Around the rink.
So while the NFL is trying to figure out who's getting into the Hall of Fame next year, and I promise we will get into the trade talks and everything else that's happened with the NHL, the draft, all of that, we'll get into that in a little while. But because we were talking about Hall of Fame inductions for the NFL and who's coming up for induction, the NHL has already announced who is going in to the Hall come November. The list includes Herb Carnegie, Rika Salomon, Daniel Alfredson, Roberto Luongo, and the Sedin twins, Henrik and Daniel Sedin. Rika Salomon is the first female hockey player outside of North America to get inducted into the Hall of Fame. She had a distinguished career playing for Finland on the international level. Herb Carnegie was a huge impact in the African-American culture and the game of hockey. He's probably the second biggest, most influential black athlete around the NHL besides Willie O'Ree, who broke the color barrier. But Herb Carnegie was a huge driving force to help get black players more involved in the game of hockey and help evolve the game of hockey for people of color. But as far as the players getting in, we have Daniel Alfredson, who's probably the second, or probably one of the biggest offensive stars of his time. Was a captain from the Ottawa Senators for I don't know how long. I've lost track how long Alfie was captain in Ottawa. But he played there from 96 to 2014. He's the Ottawa's all-time, or he took over as captain, in 99. He's Ottawa's all-time leading scorer for 426 goals, 682 helpers, and 1,108 points. He ended up adding another, he finished second in games played behind only Chris Phillips. And he missed that mark by one game in Ottawa history. Phillips played in 1179. Alfie played in 1178 in Ottawa. He played one more year in Detroit. That gave him 48 points to finish his career with 1,157 points. He won a Calder Trophy as the top rookie in the NHL. The guy was a lethal scorer, fairly good playmaker, and probably the best leader that this Ottawa Senators franchise has ever had. Alfie was a great, great skater, and which continues to prove that Sweden has a tendency of putting out great skaters and great hockey players. Sweden's known for their skating ability. Swedes are known for their skating ability. Look at some of the great Swedish skaters we've had over the years. Boreas Salming, Nick Lindstrom, Matt Sundin, Peter Forsberg. We've had a lot of great hockey players come out of Sweden. Alfredson, the Twins, you know. And we're also getting into the Hall of Fame, but what always stuck out to me with Daniel Alfredson was, aside from his leadership qualities, which Ottawa carried for most of his time as captain, his They needed somebody to be able to succeed Alexi Yashin in that department, and Alfredson showed early on that he was way better qualified to be captain material than Yashin ever was in Ottawa. Alfredson took the seat from Yashin, ran with it, made it his own until he left Ottawa at the end of the 2013-2014 season. But Alfie was the center of probably one of the more dominant lines over a three-year stretch in hockey with the cash line. It was Captain Alfredson, Spezza, and Heatley when he was teamed up with Jason Spezza and Danny Heatley. They were one of the more dominant lines in hockey for that three-year stretch that they were together. They had back-to-back 50-goal seasons out of Danny Heatley, who had pretty much resurrected his career after after what happened with his time in Atlanta. He had pretty much resurrected his career. Alfredson took his game to another level, and Jason Spezza reminded the entire hockey world of why he was taken number two overall in the 2001 entry draft, a pick which Ottawa got from the Islanders along with Zdeno Chara in the Alexi Yashin trade. So that pretty much, putting those three guys together, took Ottawa to another level and cemented themselves, at least at the time, as being one of the big threats in the NHL. And they're looking like they could be going back to that now with what's happened over the last couple of days in the trade deadline, you know, with trades in the draft, but we'll get to that in a minute. So Alfredson deserves his rightful place in the Hall of Fame, as do the Sedin twins, both of whom scored over 1,000 points each in their careers after being drafted number 2 and 3 overall in 99, which shows the brilliance of Brian Burke being able to select both of those guys and select both of them back-to-back. Spent their entire 18-year career in Vancouver, retiring finally in 2018. But Daniel was the playmaker of the two. Clearly, was the playmaker of the two. Finished with 830 assists and 1,070 points, along with the 240 goals that he scored. But his brother was clearly the better goal scorer. And that's nothing against Daniel's career, but Daniel was the setup guy. Henrik finished with 393 goals and was a pretty good passer in his own right with 648 assists for 1,041 points. He had slightly lower scoring numbers than Henrik did, but Henrik was clearly the better finisher, right? Henrik was the better finisher of the two, and he finished second on the all-time list for the Canucks with plus-minus, games played, and power play points. Those two guys were deadly together. And people always talked about, like, great chemistry with some of the 1-2 punches that the NHL has had over, you know, the course of its 100-plus year history. You can find no better chemistry, I don't think, outside of maybe the Stastny brothers than the Sedin twins, right? Because what Marion and Anton Stastny did when they were in Quebec together was pretty fun, was pretty good to watch. The Sedin twins took what the Stastnys did and took it to a completely different level. That's how instinct those two guys were. And they were the offensive backbones of the Canucks for all those successful years that Vancouver had together in the early to mid-2000s. Right, you know, in the late 2000s, early 2010s. Then you have the goaltender that's rounding out this Hall of Fame group in Roberto Luongo. Luongo finished fourth on the all-time wins list at 489. And he was second amongst goalies with over 1,000 games played. And it proved to be one of the biggest, I'll flat out say it, screw-ups that Mike Milbury had as the GM of the New York Islanders. Because when Luongo got drafted by the Islanders, at the time he was taken second overall, which at that time was the highest ever a goalie had been drafted, until the Islanders traded away Luongo to the Panthers in order to make room to be able to draft Rick DiPietro number one overall, couple years later, because the Islanders drafted Luongo in 97. 3 years later, they drafted DiPietro number one overall. We all know what happened there. Not going to get into it. But when Luongo finally found his legs under him in Florida, he basically looked at the Islanders and went,
I'll show you. You'll see.
And boy, did he ever. With the combination of him and Olli Jokinen, with what those two guys did in Florida, the Panthers hadn't really been relevant since their shocking 96 cup run before losing. They got swept out of the finals in Colorado that year, but they'd been looking to try to be able to gain respectability back, and they'd kind of found that with Luongo, with Olli Jokinen leading the team offensively and Roberto Luongo turning into the superstar that he eventually became between the pipes in Florida. Then he goes to Vancouver and takes his game to an even higher level, helping lead the Canucks to the 2011 Stanley Cup Finals, along with the Sedin Twins. And obviously a bunch of other factors still, but those three guys were the main three cogs, I feel, that the Canucks got all the way to the finals in 2011. That and the San Jose Sharks choking again in the Western Conference Finals like the Sharks always do, and did at the time. But still, having those three guys be integral parts of that 2011 Vancouver Canucks team, they were made men after that, I feel. They were made men in the city of Vancouver after that. Because it brought back, that run brought back memories of what the Canucks went through in 94, you know, before they got beaten seven games by the Rangers. And yeah, Luongo's a lot better than what Kirk McLean did in 94. And the Sedin Twins beat the tar out of what Trevor Linden and Pavel Bure did. But still, you know, it brought back memories in 94 thanks to those three guys. And seeing them get into the Hall of Fame together is, I feel, almost kind of apropos with what they did for hockey in the city of Vancouver. And for what they did for that Canucks franchise and getting them back to an even higher level than what the Canucks had previously attained. So, congratulations to all of them getting into the Hall of Fame. But once the Hall of Fame class for 2022 was announced, it really got me thinking to some of the big names that have still been left out of the Hall of Fame. They're still not in. And I talked to somebody else about this in the past with, you know, what defines Hall of Fame character. And to me, it's a couple of things. Point production, obviously. If you're one of the higher point producers in the NHL, then you're obviously going to be able to get in with Hall of Fame consideration, whether it's from the blue line or up front. And if you're a goalie, you need to put up, obviously, the win totals and a fairly decent goals against average and save percentage. But another big thing that I think plays a factor into it could also be championships. And if you don't have a lot of championships, then you're going to be left out in the cold. I'm surprised Mark Recchi hasn't got in yet. He's got two rings. One with the Penguins, and actually won a couple with Pittsburgh before finally calling it a career. I mean, Recchi scored over 570 goals and over 1,500 points in his career. How he is still not in the Hall of Fame is kind of surprising to me. How Curtis Joseph's not in the Hall of Fame with 450-plus wins is a little surprising. Pierre Turgeon's not in the Hall of Fame. He scored over 1,300 points in his career and 515 goals. Keith Kachuk's not in. See, 1,065 points and 538 goals. He's not in. John Van Beesbrouck, one of the winningest American goaltenders of all time. He's the all-time leader in games played at 882 and wins amongst American-born goalies. And I think the only one who's come close to challenging him for American netminders. It was basically like, if you think of great American goalies, four automatically come to mind when you mention American netminders. Mike Richter, John Van Beesbrouck, Tom Barrasso, and most recently, I will throw his name in there right now, especially since he's getting his number retired in Buffalo. I believe that's in early November, but Ryan Miller. I put Ryan Miller right in that argument as well. Yeah, towards the latter half of his career and the twilight of his career, he wasn't as good, but for what Ryan Miller was able to do in Buffalo, I would put Miller in that argument amongst the greatest American goaltenders of all time and should respectably at least have a shot at the Hall of Fame. But the fact that Beezer's not in, the fact that Barrasso's not in is a little bit surprising. Theo Fleury's not in the Hall of Fame, which is surprising. He scored 30 goals at least 8 times in his career out of the 15 years he was in the NHL. JR's not in, which is, now that I'm thinking about it, it is kind of shocking, but if we had a Hall of Fame for running their mouth, the two guys that would automatically be in the Hall of Fame first would be Jeremy Roenick and Brett Hull. Because they were two of the more outspoken guys in the league in the 80s and early 90s. But the fact that JR is not in the league, or is not in the hall rather, is shocking to me. He's fourth all-time in goals and points among Americans to play in the NHL. 513 goals, 1,216 points. The fact that JR is not in the Hall of Fame is surprising. Alexander Mogilny, not in the Hall of Fame. Another big surprise there. Scored over 1,000 points and 473 goals in 16 years. He's got one cup to his name. He led the Devil, helped lead the Devils to the 2000 championship. But I think part of that may have had to do with how he came over to the NHL with his defection out of Russia. which is a possibility of what's kind of kept him out. Another slight surprise is power play specialist Dave Anderchuk's not in the Hall of Fame. He finally got his ring when he won with the Lightning in 2004. But it's amazing. The guy's got more power play goals than anybody else in NHL history with 274. He scored 19. He's played in the NHL for 23 years and 19 times scored over 20 goals. How Dave Anderchuk's not in the Hall of Fame is a bit of a surprise. Tom Barrasso, we already talked about. The guy's worthy of it, considering how great, especially how great he was at the beginning of his career, with kind of helping reestablish Buffalo on the hockey map when Barrasso came into the NHL. Then you have Paul Kariya, who now that I'm saying this, I'm quite shocked he's not in the Hockey Hall of Fame yet, considering that both he and the Finnish Flesh, Teemu Selänne, helped put hockey on the map in Anaheim. They didn't have the same, how do I put this? They didn't quite have the same impact that Gretzky did when Gretzky went to LA, when he got traded to the Kings by the Oilers in 89. But still, Kariya and Selänne together, in the same vein at least, put hockey on the map in that portion of California the way Gretzky did in Hollywood when Gretzky got traded to the Kings. So the fact that Kariya's impact on the game in California and his point totals in 15 years kind of left him out. You know, he scored 40 goals three times, 100 points twice. He's got over 1,000 points in the NHL, so it is a little surprising that Kariya's left out. Erik Lindros, same thing, but I think Lindros is, I don't know why. I was going to say it's his concussion issues, but I highly doubt that. I mean, Lindros was, I think, well, as I'm thinking about this, and as I'm sitting here talking to you about this, with Lindros being left out of the Hall of Fame, if somebody's trying to make the argument that Lindros should be in the Hall, I think Lindros' concussion issues partially led to him not being in the Hall of Fame. And I also partially think that Lindros had all the hype coming into the NHL as being the next one to kind of take over for like Gretzky and Mario, but he never fully lived up to it. He had good years at the start of his career, and he had good years while he was with the Flyers, but once he left Philly, he never even remotely reached the heights that he'd hit while he was in Philly and while he was playing on the Legion of Doom line with Michael Renberg and John LeClair. So that's why I feel Lindros is partially being, you know, left out. So again, we'll obviously get into this discussion again next year when the Hall of Fame class comes out, but that's your Hall of Fame inductees for 2022 in the NHL. And there's been a lot of big news as far as like trade trackers going surrounding the draft lately. The Lightning have already made a splash, and in a couple of ways, they signed Nick Paul to a nice contract extension, and they traded away Ryan McDonagh to Nashville, which I thought was a big deal. They were able to get two prospects for McDonagh. And there had been rumors floating around that McDonagh was going to be traded for a while now to be able to make cap space for the Lightning, to be able to get younger players brought in and at least try to be able to keep the core intact. So there had been rumors floating around for a while that McDonagh was going to get traded. I was a little surprised the trade ended up getting pulled off to him going to Nashville. But the Lightning did what they had to be able to do to clear up the cap space to try to be able to re-sign a couple of guys. Because the three biggest names that were on the Lightning's free agent market were Nick Paul, Jan Ruda, and Andre Palat. And there's still question marks. I think of the two, Nick Paul's already been re-signed. He ain't going anywhere. But out of the two guys that are left with Palat and Ruda, there's some feeling amongst the Lightning fans here in Tampa and in the surrounding community, you know, in the Lightning hockey, in the Tampa hockey market, that Jan Ruda was going to be let, you know, they were going to let Jan Ruda walk anyway. There's still the possibility that they could end up bringing him back, and free agency officially starts next week. It starts on July 13th. So, which for us hockey fans is like Christmas Day. I've said this to people all the time. The two greatest days for me on the hockey calendar are, that don't have anything to do with actual games, are trade deadline day and free agency day, just to be able to see who's going to go where and like who's going to get dealt where, what draft picks are going to get moved, and with free agency days, how much teams are going to pony up to get certain players. And we've seen a lot of trades go down the last couple of days that could end up having huge impacts on teams for excuse me, for future considerations. So the Lightning end up getting rid of McDonough. Then the next day, then over the last couple of days, we've had two big trades. Colorado ends up giving up three draft picks, two for this year, a third and a fifth, and a third round pick in next year's draft. Colorado sends that to the New York Rangers in exchange for Alexander Georgiev. Now, Georgiev is a restricted free agent anyway, so I think Colorado's going to end up working on trying to be able to re-sign him. The Rangers clearly have their set man in Igor Shesterkin. He's their number one guy. There's no argument there that Igor's the man on Broadway, right? Igor's set. So Georgiev became expendable, and Georgie's now in Colorado, which I think is also trying to shore up whatever's going on behind Darcy Kemper, which may mean they have trouble with the comfortability level of Pavel Francouz as the backup. I don't really know. I don't know. I mean, hey, good on the Rangers for restocking draft picks and trying to be able to build upon a greater future than what they have already. Because there's a lot of promise on Broadway right now, especially with them coming off the Eastern Conference Finals appearance and having Igor Shesterkin had the year that he's had. But now I'm curious just to see what they're going to do for the backup role. There was that. Then there was Alex DeBrincat getting traded, and there'd been rumors flying around for a while now that the Hawks were looking to possibly make a trade. They pulled the trigger on it, getting rid of a first-round pick, a second-round pick, and a third-round pick in 2024. The Hawks got that in exchange with Ottawa for DeBrincat. And that's why I said before, I kind of think that the Senators are showing that they're sort of on the upswing, if you will, with how they're looking by picking up a guy on the talent level of Alex DeBrincat, who's a 20-plus goal scorer. I mean, and he's got the ability to pot 40 or 50 goals. DeBrincat's that good. But you throw him in with the likes of Thomas Chabot. You throw him in with the likes of, who else does Ottawa have? That's really, they've got talent there in Ottawa. They've got Tim Stützle. They've got Brady Tkachuk. They've got Austin Watson. Nikita Zaitsev. They've got plenty of talent here in Ottawa to be able to build on. And now that you had a guy like Alex DeBrincat there, that's saying a lot for the Senators who are going to be on the upswing. I still think it's going to be a little while before Ottawa truly finds their stride. But being able to get like a guy like Alex DeBrincat says a lot. And it says that Ottawa's going in the right direction, which is the complete opposite for the Blackhawks, who are going on the downslide, if you will, by getting rid of one of their top up-and-coming stars in Alex DeBrincat. They still have Kane and Taves, but both guys are getting older and are well past the three cups in 6 years that we saw out of Chicago 10 years ago. This is not the same Hawks team. They don't have that talent level anymore, and I'm really worried that Chicago is going to be buried in the basement for a while. I'm really concerned about that for the Hawks.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt this program for a special announcement.
Oh, but wait, the trade talks are not done. This just came over the wire a little while ago. There's a trade between the New Jersey Devils and the Washington Capitals. The Capitals are getting a 2022 second-round pick and a 2022 third-round pick in exchange for a second-round pick and Vitek Vanacek. Wow, that's a surprise. This came down about half an hour ago. Vanacek to the Devils, along with a second-round pick in this year's draft, for a second and a third this year going to Washington. Wow, I actually like that trade a lot for the Devils, because they just got themselves now a 20-win goaltender from last year, and he's definitely going to be shoring up the nets in New Jersey, that you now have Vitek Vanacek in goal, when you've been looking at the likes of Jonathan Bernier and Mackenzie Blackwood and Andrew Hammond operating the nets in Washington last year, or in New Jersey last year. So you're adding a 20-win goaltender right there and getting Vitek Vanacek. That's huge. That's huge for New Jersey being able to pick up Vanacek in goal. Fantastic trade by New Jersey. And that leaves Ilya Samsonov and Phoenix Copley as the two goalies now in Washington. I like Vanacek. I mean, hey, Vanacek and Samsonov made a pretty good 1-2 punch last year. But this is now going to be all on Ilya Samsonov in Washington with Vanecek now in Jersey. So I like that trade a lot for the Devils. A lot going on in the NHL. A lot happening in the NHL right now. There's plenty to get excited about. And we haven't even hit free agency yet in the NHL. So this has been good. Like, really good. We'll break down more of the rest of the draft on the blog, SallySports.blogspot.com, in the next coming days. So while the NHL is trying to figure out what's going on with the draft and more trades, we are getting geared up for the All-Star break around Major League Baseball as we have officially hit the more than halfway point of the baseball season. Let's get into that right now as it's time for us to go
around the majors.
So here we sit with a little over a week to go before the All-Star break around Major League Baseball, and there's a lot happening around Major League Baseball. A lot happening. The way it looks right now, we're sitting at, the Yankees have the best record in baseball at 60 wins, 16-23. They're 14 and a half up on the next best team, the Tampa Bay Rays, who have vaulted ahead of the Red Sox and the Jays for second place in the American League's Eastern Division, because the Red Sox have lost three straight. The Rays are playing 500 baseball in their last 10 games, and the Jays, like the Red Sox, have lost seven of their last 10. And you have the Twins at 47 wins leading the Central, and the Astros at 54 wins leading the West. Now, the only other teams in the Central and West with 500 or better records are the Cleveland Guardians, right at 500 at 40-40, and the Mariners at 42-42. Everybody else is playing under 500 ball in the American League. You have the Rays, Red Sox, and Blue Jays all with 45 wins, but the Rays have second place because they have fewer losses than the other two teams. You look at the National League, the Mets sit a half game behind the Dodgers for the best record in the NL. The Dodgers are at 53-29. The Mets are at 52-31 following the Mets win last night over Miami. The only other teams with winning records in the NL East are the Braves and Phillies. The Braves at 49 wins, the Phillies at 44. Then you have the Marlins and Nats. NL Central, it's 47-win Milwaukee, 45-win St. Louis, and then 34-win Pittsburgh, 34-win Chicago, and the 29-win Cincinnati Reds. Then you have the toughest division in baseball, the 53-win Dodgers, the 48-win Padres, and the 41-win Giants. Now, the Giants are a little bit surprising. They've come back down to earth after last year. And San Diego, despite not having Fernando Tatis Jr. in the lineup, are still proving why they're one of the deeper and better teams in baseball with 48 wins. And you know what? So far to this point, and we'll probably end up doing this again next week when we actually look at, like, MVPs and all that stuff and biggest surprises from the first half. But I got to admit, the San Diego Padres have been a very nice and a very comfortable surprise coming out of the NL West because of what they've been able to do without Tatis. And they've got Manny Machado, who's been hitting the cover off the ball. Jackson Profar's been driving in runs. Jake Cronenworth has been an RBI machine. He's second on the team behind only Manny Machado. They've got Ha Sung Kim, who's been a pleasant surprise. And Luke Voit, who's been hitting the cover off the ball. So San Diego's been a very nice surprise without having Manny Machado, without having Fernando Tatis in the lineup. And everybody's already started doing their predictions for who's going to be playing in the All-Star game. They haven't officially announced All-Star starters yet, or the All-Star rosters yet. That'll be done by the end of this weekend. We'll know who's going to be playing in the All-Star game, and that'll be put up on the blog, SallySports.blogspot.com, when the All-Star rosters officially become announced. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in-depth on the show next week. But leading vote getters for me and guys who should be in contention, I'd put Alejandro Kirk into that mix, the catcher out of Toronto to start for the American League. I'd put Vlad Guerrero at first with the year he's having. I'd put Altuve at second out of Houston. I'd put Jose Ramirez out of Cleveland because, let's face facts, Jose Ramirez, for as good as Rafael Devers has been in Boston this year, Jose Ramirez is the leading RBI guy in the American League, and he's doing it for a Cleveland team who's playing right at 500 right now, but this is a Guardians team that wasn't really truly projected to be like one of the higher power teams, if you will. But hey, they're hanging around in the Central, and they're still at least keeping the pressure up on the White Sox. That's over at third. At short, it's probably going to end up being Xander Bogaerts from Boston. your outfielders, I'd probably put Byron Buxton into the mix. You definitely have to put Mike Trout up there because Mike Trout's playing well like Mike Trout. And then you have Aaron Judge, who has been hitting the absolute cover off the baseball. This is the second time in his career that he's hit 30 or more home runs before the All-Star break. And he had 28 home runs, I think, by the end of June, which only one other guy in Yankee history has ever hit more than that. Maybe you've heard of him, some guy named Babe Ruth, who's hit 29 and 30 home runs in two different seasons before the end of the month of June. So Aaron Judge is hitting rarefied air. And the fact that this man has not signed the contract extension yet is still shocking to me. But at the same time, it's like I'm not surprised because he felt he was getting lowballed by the Yankees. And he's now wanting an offer. He's now putting on a year that's going to force the hand of somebody to pay him a crap ton of money. And he's going to be worth every bit of it. For designated hitter for the American League, I could throw in Shohei Ohtani to the argument, but probably the best one for that role to at least start the All-Star game would probably be Yordan Alvarez with the year he's having in Houston. As far as the National League is concerned, at least as far as starters go, guys I'd put into consideration for starting for the NL, it's probably going to end up being Wilson Contreras behind the plate out of Chicago. I put Paul Goldschmidt at first out of St. Louis. You could look at Jazz Chisholm in Miami to play second base, but let's be real here. It's probably going to end up being Tommy Edman of the Cardinals. Manny Machado, to me, is pretty much like a runaway at this point at third base out of San Diego. The only other guy I'd consider starting at third out of the National League would be Nolan Arenado over in St. Louis. Short, I'd probably end up giving it to either Trey Turner of the Dodgers or Dansby Swanson of the Braves. For the outfield, I'd consider giving it to Acuna, but Mookie Betts with the type of year he's having, Kyle Schwarber with the year he's having, Juan Soto with the year he's having, the outfield is a lot more jumbled up in the National League with who to be able to hit, to be able to pick. You know, I'd probably be able to put Bryce Harper at DH, but there's a lot of names and that I'm going to be surprised that I'll see pop up for who's going to be going for who for the All-Star game. So wait and see and hopefully have this figured out and settled and we can have everything for you by the time the rosters come out on Sunday. And we'll wait and see where we go from there. But as far as the three teams that we cover on this show, the Mets, the Yankees, and the Rays, the Mets have been a pleasant surprise in that they've been able to do what they've been able to do this year from a pitching perspective without the majority of their aces being here for most of the year. Jake hasn't thrown a pitch. And Mad Max Scherzer has missed a significant amount of time this year. I mean, Scherzer's still like 5-2, and he's got, I'm double checking Scherzer's strikeout totals now. I mean, the Mets have won two straight. But looking at the numbers that Scherzer's put up this year, Scherzer is, where is his totals for the year? He's 5-1 in six starts. With a 2.26 ERA and 70 strikeouts. Impressive numbers. Actually, I'll go so far as to say this for Max Scherzer's numbers.
Holy shnikes.
But then again, at the same time, as I'm saying that, I realize that even at 37 years old, Max Scherzer is still, well, Max Scherzer. I mean, Carlos Carrasco's leading this team with 9 wins, but still, the fact that Scherzer's been able to do what he's been able to do, and the Mets have been able to hang on with a 9-4 Carlos Carrasco leading the way, and a 6-5 and a 7-2 Taijuan Walker, but Carrasco's got an ERA over 4, which worries me a little bit. So, the Mets pitching is kind of leveled off a little bit. Their hitting's been great. You know, Alonso's driven in 69 runs. You got Lindor kind of close behind him at 57, and I think the only other guy with over 40 is Starling Marte right at 40. So, the Mets offense has been finding ways to get it done. They hung a 10 spot last night, and a 10-0 win. So, there's a lot to be positive about with the Mets right now at 52-31. There's been a lot of high hopes for the Mets coming into this year, and the fact that they hung a 10 spot and shut out Miami last night before over 30,000+ people says a lot. It says a lot for what the Mets have been able to do. The Yankees, this is pretty much a given at this point. They've been running away with the American League from the start of the year with the offensive bludgerings that they've been able to put on everybody. They hung a 16 spot on the Pirates 2 nights ago, which is saying a lot. A 16 spot on Pittsburgh. Yes, I realize it's still the crappy Pittsburgh Pirates, but at the same time, to be able to put up 16 runs like that is pretty impressive. You already got 30 home runs from Judge and 64 RBIs. You got 22 out of Anthony Rizzo. You got 21 out of Stanton in the home run department. Stanton's got over 50 RBIs. This team is producing and producing at a fairly scary clip. LeMahieu's been hitting. Glaber's been hitting. You're getting run production from Josh Donaldson and Aaron Hicks occasionally. Joey Gallo, there's been a lot of talk about him early in the year, but his bat seemed to slow down a little bit. And in the pitching department, Gerrit Cole is still doing Gerrit Cole things. He's 8-2 with a 3.26 ERA and 124 strikeouts. But you got Nestor Cortez, who's at 7-3 with a 2.44 ERA and 91 Ks. This pitching has been a surprise with how good. I mean, Gerrit Cole has been basically pitching like Gerrit Cole most of the year. Come on now. Gerrit Cole's been able to do Gerrit Cole things. It's Nestor Cortez that has been the big surprise in being able to build big things up behind Gerrit Cole and give him more support there. And when you think of closers, Clay Holmes has done a fantastic job coming out of the pen for the Yankees this year to be able to shut the door when you haven't exactly had his reliable source, shall we say, as you've had with Aroldis Chapman in the past. So we got all that going on with the Bombers, and now you look at a team like the Rays, which to me has been a pleasant surprise. Well, actually, I shouldn't necessarily say it's been a pleasant surprise, but because, you know, the Rays are the two-time defending American League Eastern Division champions, and they won over 100 games last year, but they're coming off back-to-back wins over the Red Sox, and this after taking 3 out of 5 from Toronto after a 4-game losing streak. They swept the Pirates, lost 2 to the Brewers, and the first 2 to Toronto. Come back, finish winning the last 3 games of that series, get shut out by Boston, but then beat them in the last 2 and beat them fairly handedly in the last 2. And oh, by the way, they're doing this with a few guys out hurt. They still don't have J.P. Feierheisen. They still don't have Andrew Kitchener. They still don't have Mike Zunino, who are all out hurt, but they're starting to get guys healthy again. You know, Wander's back and he's producing. Kiermaier, even though he had a bit of a mental brain fart the other night against Boston, has been playing solid baseball. The biggest story, though, for me, at least it's been a huge surprise, has been the play of Isak Paredes. As of late, this guy,
oh, brother, we are not worthy!
With how well he's been hitting the ball as of late, is truly at an eye-popping number what Isak Paredes has been able to do. 13 home runs and 28 RBIs. Yes, I'd like to be able to see guys get on more ahead of him, but 3 home run night a couple nights ago. He had a big night against Toronto, driving in 4 last Sunday and an 11-5 win. But this guy's been hitting the cover off the ball as of late and is starting to be able to cement himself more as a steadying force at first base and allowing G-Man Choi to be able to DH more for the Rays. So there's things that are starting to come together in Tampa. Will it be possible for them to catch the Yankees? I hate saying it, and a lot could change the second half of the season, but I doubt it just because the Yankees have built themselves up so far of a lead in the American League East that I think it might be tough to be able to catch the Bombers for the division title. But at least the Rays know that they have pieces that they can work with to be able to at least launch themselves into a wild card position and make the playoffs for the 3rd consecutive year. So it's going to make for a lot of fun to follow the second half of the year, and we'll break this down more on the show next week when we get to the first half recap, so there's going to be plenty to talk about then. But that's then. We have run out of time for this episode of the show. We'll talk about more of this stuff and plenty else happening in the sports world next week on the show. You can follow us on various forms of social media, facebook.com/SallyOnSports, Twitter @SallyOnSports, and you can use the #SallyOnSports across all platforms of social media to be able to keep up with the show, keep up with everything happening in the sports world, and you can ask me questions. I'll answer them every week right here on the program. We have our blog, sallysport.blogspot.com. All the latest episodes of the show can be found on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and anywhere else that you get your podcast. And every other piece of audio we've ever got can be found on SoundCloud. All you gotta do is search Sally on Sports, hit download, and you can take the show with you wherever you go. Until we tee it up again next time here on the program, this has been Sally on Sports. I'm Matt Solomon, and until I talk to you again next time,
boom shakalaka turn up.